What does the U.S. have that Europe wants?
How about economic growth?
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org.
Coming up, another stalemate in Washington puts more than a million jobs at risk.
Forget the Supreme Court. What do Americans think about the individual mandate?
And some friendly tips to avoid getting scammed by your coworkers should you happen to win the lottery.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
The number of people applying for unemployment benefits dropped last week to 359,000. That's a four-year low, and we'll have more on that in just a moment.
But first, Best Buy said today that it's closing 50 big box stores after losing almost $2 billion over the last few months. Faith Hope Consolo is a retail analyst with Prudential Douglas Elliman in New York. She says Best Buy's big box model might not be a model for the future.
The big box has been knocked out of the box by the real superstores or the Kmarts, Walmarts of the world. Electronics we've seen declining in the store category, so much ordering online, and we've seen a lot more shopping via the app.
And speaking of apps, Best Buy plans to open about 100 small mobile phone stores in the next year or so.
Now let's get to the big picture of the U.S. economy. Diane Swonk is chief economist with Mesirow Financial, and she's with us now from Chicago, as always. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, in addition to those good jobless numbers that I reported a minute ago, the government also said that the economy grew 3% last quarter. How do you read that?
Well, that's what we had already estimated on the U.S. economy, and much of that growth came from inventories we were restocking after the Japanese earthquake. So some of it's not sustained, but, you know, better to get 3% than nothing. And so we are moving up. The economy has reaccelerated after nearly stalling out in 2011.
Well, square it with what we heard today from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. They came out with a report that said the U.S. economy and the European economies are going to diverge this year as the U.S. grows and Europe shrinks.
Absolutely. The problem for Europe is they're going through deep austerity programs. The periphery is getting very hard hit, and there is some spillover into France, although we've yet to see full effects on Germany. The bottom line is it's hard for Europe to keep growing when they've had to cut so dramatically to bring their deficits down. We've not begun to do that, and of course, we're growing more strongly.
And have we walled ourselves off from the problems over there yet?
We've not walled ourselves off. There's spillover effects because China, Europe is China's largest client, and we ship a lot to China, and we've already seen exports slow not only to Europe, but more directly to China. And so we are still have some effects of it. It's just that our domestic economy is holding up better than Europe's can under the circumstances.
Diane Swonk, chief economist with Mesirow Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Construction on roads and bridges around the country could grind to a halt this weekend. That's because federal transportation funding expires on Saturday, and Republicans and Democrats in the House have yet to agree on an extension of that funding. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
More than a million construction jobs could be on the line if Congress can't reach a deal. The Senate has passed a $109 billion bipartisan bill that would fund transportation projects for 2 years. The House hasn't been able to agree on its own bill. Now Republican leaders are working on a short-term extension. If they fail, Lauren Smith with Capital Alpha Partners says it's not clear exactly how many workers could be laid off.
But certainly, should the highway programs be suspended on Saturday night, you would see all manner of project stop, and that would definitely create a disruption.
Without an extension, the federal gas tax would also drop by about 14 cents a gallon. But don't get too excited. There's nothing to stop oil companies from charging the same prices and pocketing the difference. And Smith says some states have laws that would automatically raise their own taxes if the federal tax is suspended. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
A Senate committee is holding a hearing on gas prices today. They've been climbing here in the U.S., $3.90 a gallon on average at the moment. One culprit for rising costs, refineries shutting down. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
It may sound odd, but high oil prices are actually hurting some oil refiners, especially on the East Coast, says analyst Gene McGillion.
Two of them were shut, and there's a third refinery that's possibly going to be shut this coming summer if Sunoco, who owns it, can't find a buyer for it.
Valero just idled a refinery in the Caribbean as well. The problem? Those refineries were processing high-quality crude oil from the North Sea. Prices for so-called Brent crude have risen dramatically, and with U.S. gasoline demand falling, industry consultant Andy Lipow says there was no way they could pass the higher prices along to consumers.
There's not enough margin left for them to cover their operating costs and make money.
Those refinery shutdowns have helped raise gas prices on the East Coast. Not all refiners are as squeezed, though. Holly Frontier, a Midwestern refiner that processes cheaper, heavier crudes from Canada, made $1 billion last year. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
Now to the Marketplace Global Perspective. Thousands of protesters are taking to the streets today in Spain. They're objecting to deep government cuts and sweeping reforms there. Spain has the highest unemployment rate in the European Union, and the government is hoping changes to labor laws will help kickstart the economy. The BBC's Tom Burridge joins us now from Madrid. Good morning, Tom.
Morning, Stacey.
So, Tom, you've been out and about in the streets today. Tell us what you're seeing.
Well, I mean, in terms of the atmosphere, it's slightly strange atmosphere on the streets of Madrid today. It's not a usual day. There's less traffic, less people. There have been pickets all across Madrid. We saw some demonstrations out in the streets earlier, and those demonstrations are expected to peak this evening, and I think we'll see large crowds. I'd be surprised if we don't see hundreds of thousands of people on the streets of Madrid and other big cities across the country.
Talk to us a little bit about the cuts themselves. What is the government trying to achieve, and what are some of the cuts that strikers are protesting?
Let's go back to when the government came into power at the end of last year. So they took power. They said that the situation they were left with, the financial situation, was a lot worse than they were led to believe by the previous government. So they're now under pressure from Brussels, officials in the European Union, to cut their budget deficit, cut their public spending a lot more, raise more revenue in tax. And so there is an impression here in Madrid and across Spain that really, with some people at least, they feel that the European Union, that Brussels is calling the shots.
And those are some police helicopters in the background, from what I understand. Is that right?
That's right. We've got a police helicopter just circling above me now. And as I said, there is a lot of police on the street.
And Tom, one last question. How do you expect these strikes to play into the government reforms?
Well, I don't think they're going to have any impact at all on what we're going to see from the government on Friday. The Spanish government has come out and said, look, this strike is not going to help us. It's not going to do any good. And ultimately, we're not going to change any of our reforms as a result of these protests.
The BBC's Tom Burridge in Madrid. Tom, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Today, a group of emerging market countries gathered in New Delhi for a summit. Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, known as the BRICS, came together to discuss economic stability.
The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar is right outside of the summit in New Delhi. Good morning, Sanjoy.
Good morning.
The BRICS nations came out today blaming rich countries for the current economic turmoil. What was the reasoning behind this?
Well, these are countries who together contribute to about 20% of the global economy, and there's an increasing sense that events that are well beyond their control are shaping their lives and their economies. These are economies that have done significantly well over the past decade, but are also slowing down, perhaps not as quite as much as some of the Western economies, but slowing down nevertheless. And given that they have very large populations who need food and access to energy such as oil and gas, they're quite concerned.
What are the BRICS countries calling for out of this summit?
Well, there are two separate things. On the one hand, they're looking at ways to try and put in place systems which allow them to work outside of the current global financial system. So they've decided to try and set up a lending bank of their own, modeled along the lines of the World Bank, which can fund infrastructure and development projects in places such as Africa, but also lend money in times of need. And they're also trying to set up systems where they can trade in each other's currencies and not using the dollar as a unit of trade.
Can the BRICS countries get what they want from developed countries? Do they have any bargaining power here?
Well, I think there's a great sense that these are five very influential countries, mainly because of the size of their economies and the size of their markets. So they do have some bargaining power there. Having said that, the problem with the BRICS has always been that they're fairly disparate nations with varying political and economic systems and often competing with each other. So while they may come together on a stage and platform such as the BRICS, there's a sense very much that there's not much they can do beyond this.
The BBC's Sanjoy Majumdar is covering the BRICS summit in New Delhi. Sanjoy, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, now back to the United States, where President Obama's health care law has been under discussion all week at the Supreme Court, and specifically the part of the law that would require some uninsured Americans to buy health insurance. It's called the individual mandate. Well, according to Gallup, more than 7 in 10 Americans think the individual mandate is unconstitutional, which brings us to a segment we call Attitude Check.
And the latest poll number suggests
margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at the polling firm Gallup, and he joins us now. Good morning, Frank.
Hi, good morning.
Well, is it just the individual mandate part of the law that Americans don't seem to like, or is it something more fundamental?
You know, looking over the research in terms of the specifics of the law, it is the individual mandate which is the most negative of anything that's tested. In fact, some of the other aspects of the law individually, like allowing 18 to 25-year-olds to ride on their parents' policies and to make sure that you're not denied coverage because of pre-existing conditions, those are fairly wildly popular in a lot of polling. But most polling shows that in addition to saying it's unconstitutional, Americans just don't like the idea of the individual mandate. So when you look at it specifically, that is the big kahuna. That's the thing that Americans really are most negative about. And I think that's in part because that represents bigness. Big government requiring everybody to have insurance, and that's in the bigger sense what Americans are really sensitive to.
So they don't like bigness, but do you get a sense in your polling of what they do want in healthcare?
Well, they do want a lot of specifics. You know, if you say, should the government just very narrowly say that you cannot be denied health care coverage because of a pre-existing condition, Americans say, sure, that's something the government should do. The problem is bundling. That's how I look at it, having reviewed a lot of the data. When you bundle all this together, then Americans say, wait a minute, when you start doing all these things with the bill, then all of a sudden you've got government doing a lot, and Americans are very negative on a number of aspects of the federal government at this point. They think it's inefficient. They think it's already too big. There are too many regulations. And so on and so forth.
Well, do Americans see the health care issue as a big problem?
You know, it's latent versus manifest. How's that for an answer? It is a latent concern. If you simply ask Americans overall, what's the most important problem facing the country, which we just did in March, 5% mentioned health care, a very small number. It's swamped by mentions of the economy. Even dissatisfaction with the government is higher than health care. So it's not top of mind, and partially that's because most Americans actually have health care coverage, which they're fairly positive about. But latent concern is what I come back to, because if you read a list to Americans, say, all right, how much do you worry about each of these problems, or how concerned are you as a policy issue about blah, 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 healthcare will in fact percolate right up there fairly close to the top. So it's not top of mind. Americans aren't vexed by it like they are the job situation. But underneath it all, Americans do think it is a significant problem.
Frank Newport is editor-in-chief at Gallup. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
This week at Marketplace, we're looking at how technology is changing the American workforce in a series called Robots Ate My Job. Today, we hear from David Novak Jr., a robot technician for Toyota in southern Indiana.
Robots are basically pretty dumb.
Every robot has its job, and if that job doesn't work, we've got to figure out why.
You have to tell it to go from point A to point B. I tell it to weld here and there and everywhere else.
We'll take you down here to the first part of the tack line.
The area that I work in is what they call the underbody. So basically when you're driving down the road, if you're sitting on it, that's something I had something to do with.
That van right there has a front sunroof with a roof rack. The next one is going to have a regular roof.
In my senior year in high school, and I was bound and determined I wanted to be a school teacher. But as my mom always said, I had champagne taste on a beer budget.
This is a maintenance workstation here. Anything we should need to do, we can do from this computer.
So a friend of mine came into school, and he brought a robot into our computer programming class. And I watched him enter some machine language and watched this robot do a little dance. And I thought, that was pretty neat. And once he described there's always going to be a job, you're guaranteed good salaries, I decided to go for that instead.
If the one on the side is going red, that means there's a problem with that robot on that side of the line. Like right now, there's a problem down there.
The robots are also doing jobs that are more dangerous. Somebody trying to carry weld guns all day long and do these welds, they're going to end up within a year and a half, 2 years, they're not going to be able to move their arms because their shoulders are bad. I wouldn't want to be that person. So I would rather have a robot doing it than somebody else doing it and suffering.
Each position this robot welds, somebody has to teach it.
Whenever I left my field service job, before I'd even got on the interstate, I had another job. So I was without a job for 10 minutes. So you'll never be unemployed. That's just the way I've found things to be.
Ann Hepperman produced our story. For more of the Robots Ate My Job series, you can head to our website. It's marketplace.org.
So, Jeremy, I don't know, did you go to kindergarten? Not everybody does.
I did, of course, yeah.
Yeah, was it just a public kindergarten or?
Yeah, a public kindergarten and lots of finger painting and arts
yeah,
and crafts.
Yeah, nap time,
and nap
snacks.
Time and recess, stuff like that.
Well, then you'll probably be as surprised as I was to hear this. Apparently, more parents are taking out student loans for their kids' kindergarten tuition.
Oh, man.
That's according to a story in the Wall Street Journal Smart Money. It says that kindergarten loans are up 10% from last year. And the tuition is, this is what really surprised me, is $10,000 at a lot of these kindergartens.
That is unbelievable.
I know. But as a bonus, I think, you know, you get to meet the lovable new character, Dora the Loan Shark.
Tomorrow there will be a Mega Millions lottery drawing like never before. $500 million. That's the biggest lotto jackpot ever. And if you plan on buying tickets with your coworkers, our senior business correspondent Bob Moon has some things for you to consider.
The big drawing comes just a couple of weeks after a judge ordered a New Jersey construction worker to share a $24 million jackpot with five coworkers. He'd insisted he'd won with a personal ticket, bought separately. The moral, as the state's lottery director Carol Hettinger sees it, have a clear agreement with your coworkers, not just a handshake.
Preferably those rules should be in writing so that everybody understands what they are.
Establish a clear line between playing for yourself and picking up tickets for the office pool.
Buy the group tickets one place, buy your own tickets someplace else. Keep your own tickets separate.
And give each coworker their own documentation.
Making copies of the tickets and handing them out to everyone prior to the draw guarantees safety for everyone.
Sounds simple enough, except you might just want to think twice about using the office copy machine.
I would only suggest people do that with the permission of their employers. But I know that a lot of employers join those pools as well, so maybe they'll be in favor of making copies.
Just to avoid confusion, everyone here at Marketplace, please listen up. When I win tomorrow, it's mine, all mine. I like the sound of that. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The Recording Industry Association of America's released sales numbers for 2011. And one piece of big news, digital formats now make up over 50% of total music shipments in the United States, which means they now beat CDs and vinyl sales.
Here to talk with us for our Midday Extra is Josh Friedlander. He is VP of Strategic Data Analysis at the RIAA. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. So how big of a milestone is this that digital sales are now outpacing physical sales?
Well, this is actually a very big milestone, but it's been building for years. The industry went virtually from all physical about 7 years ago to 50% digital today. Last year it was 46%, so clearly this has been building over time. And I think it shows how the industry has quickly adapted to the internet.
Was there anything unexpected in the report?
Sure, there's always something that's going to be unexpected. I try to keep my finger on what's going on in the market on a regular basis. So most of what we see for the full year we've been seeing over time, but there are always some unexpected surprises. One of the things that's been growing actually over time, but vinyl continues to be very strong, even as digital continues to grow.
Oh, wow.
And last year we had a big surprise in a big new star named Adele, who sold more albums than anyone has in about half a decade.
What's her name again? Adele?
I feel like I've heard of her.
Josh, vinyl, I assume that's just like a bunch of DJs that are or hipsters that are out there getting their vinyl albums because they sound better.
Well, I don't know if people are buying them necessarily for the sound. I think people buy them because they're very collectible and people like connecting an artist in lots of different ways. And having a physical item to have in your house really says something about who you are and the music that you like. Lots of the vinyl albums are actually sold with MP3 codes so that you could download the songs digitally and listen to them on your device. So people might not actually be even listening to them on record players.
Hey, are people buying the full albums when they buy the digital music yet, or are people still just buying singles?
Actually, we crossed another threshold last year. In 2011, it was the first time there were over 100 million digital albums sold. And for the last couple of years, digital albums have actually been growing faster than digital singles. Hmm. So we're really seeing consumer adoption of that format.
Josh, is the music industry rebounding? I know it really took a hit for several years. Is it too soon to tell, or are we seeing some green shoots here?
I would say it's stabilizing. 2011 was up a little bit, but it was mostly flat. There are still some really huge challenges facing the industry. There's still tons of illegal acquisition from peer-to-peer and other forms of illegal file sharing. So I'm not ready to say it's all the way back.
Josh Friedlander is VP of Strategic Data Analysis at RIAA. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
And finally, Stacey, in the UK, there's a parrot named Chica that was stolen over the weekend.
Oh.
But the owner says it's possible the thieves won't want to keep the bird around for too long because it turns out that the bird's favorite activity is singing a classic hit by the band Queen.
Galileo! Galileo!
Galileo!
Magnifico!
Yep, that's right, Stacey. Chico loves her some Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh my gosh.
The owner tells the Sun newspaper, quote, "I don't think the people who have her will appreciate her squawking Scaramouche at them all the time." Probably not. Hopefully
that is karma. Yeah. I think that's karma right there.
Let poor Chico go. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.